Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Phoenix Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to Phoenix Business Radio, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studio inside Max 6 Workspace and the Conscious Capitalism Arizona headquarters in Tempe, Arizona, where we help build businesses and connect you with the right people. I'm Karen Nowicki, and I am very excited to be in the studio today with a new friend, Gary Stewart. He's an author, attorney, law professor, and mentioned to me as we were rehearsing how I would introduce him, a man of many other wonderful titles, even some that are more important than the ones I just shared. But today we're here not only to get to know Gary, but also to celebrate his new book that I believe has just been launched. There's a celebration coming up here this month. And the book is called Call Him Mac. It is a story about Ernest W. McFarland and the Arizona years. Welcome to the studio, Gary.
Oh, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
I'm thrilled to have you. So before we dive into the book, well, maybe we should. Let's dive into the book, and then I want to kind of go backwards a little bit and talk about you as an author and all these incredible things that you've done throughout your career as well. But let's talk about Ernest McFarland. Who is he? He's a new historian or a statesman to me. Fill in the blanks for us.
He's new to so many people that it's surprising to me. I met Mac. He insisted that everybody that ever met him call him Mac. Not senator, not governor, not Mr. Chief Justice, Mac. So Mac is unique in the history of America. He is the only person in history to serve as the governor of his state, the Chief Justice of his state, as a trial judge in his state, as a U.S. senator from his state, as the majority leader in the U.S. Senate during a time of war. He is the only American to ever get all of that. That's the trio of everything, because as a wonderful judge wrote a foreword to my book, he said, Mac was a guy who couldn't keep a job. And so when you think about his long history, his political history, his business history, that describes Mac in perfect ways. He liked every job he ever had, but he moved from job to job as times and the events and the things surrounding his life required him to. But he was a unique human being.
And so many titles, let alone firsts.
Yes.
Someone who has been just a mainstay for Arizona. And I don't recall, but I'm also not really great with history, admittedly. I don't recall studying or learning about him when I was in high school doing Arizona studies. Surely, in your research, it's part of our program, isn't it, for our young learners?
Yeah. It's a very, very big part of Arizona's history and Arizona's relationship to all the other states, particularly the southwestern states. Largely because of his fascination with and his mastery of water law. In his time, he knew more about water law than anyone knew. He argued the United States Supreme Court case for the Central Arizona Project himself, argued the case. He wrote many, many legal opinions about water law, and he practiced it his whole life. So that makes him central to Arizona's single largest issue, which is water.
What brought him to Arizona was...
Yeah, that story could be a book in and of itself. So Mac was an Oklahoma farm boy. He was born in 1894 in Oklahoma on a fairly sizable farm. By those standards then, it wasn't corporate agriculture. It was his family farm. He got a degree in, I think, 1914 from the University of Oklahoma. And not long after that, as the First World War started ramping up, Mac joined the Navy as an ordinary seaman. And he went to what was basic training or boot camp in the Navy in Illinois. That was the naval station there. He spent a total of about 400 days total in the U.S. Navy. 330 of those days he was in the hospital. He was dangerously close to death many times. He almost died several times. And as a consequence of good Navy doctoring and time, he lived through that. So So when he got out of the Navy in 1918, he went back to Oklahoma, stayed there for a few months, and realized that given his health, he wasn't frail, he was robust and strong. But given his health condition and what had put him into all of this massive trouble, the influenza, the Spanish flu, the famous one that killed 5% of the American citizen population, he lived through that. He lived through the pneumonia that he got as a consequence of that. He came to Arizona on his own, by himself, with a $10 bill total in his pocket, in uniform, in his U.S. Navy uniform. So he arrived here, went to work in Phoenix, not for very long, worked in a bank in Phoenix, the original Valley Bank in Phoenix.
Yeah.
That didn't last very long. He decided to do what he'd always wanted to do, which is to go to law school. The University of Arizona had a very strong law school at the time. He was living in Casa Grande, in the Florence area, close to Tucson, but he went to Stanford. Instead of the Arizona University of Arizona Law School, he picked the Stanford Law School.
Do we know why he was drawn there instead of here?
Yeah, I was hoping you'd ask. It was free.
Oh, well, that's a heck of a draw.
That's a draw. At the time, yes. Stanford University, if you were admitted to Stanford, there was no tuition. It was a private university. So he spent 4 years there. He got a law degree, and he got a master's degree in political science. And it's that master's degree added to the law degree that changed everything for Mac and for us, the rest of us, over time. It was that degree in political science. So he married and managed and conflabbed, for lack of a better word, political science and law. So for a rural lawyer, he became a rural lawyer. He moved to Florence, Arizona, because they elected him Pinal County Attorney.
Oh.
That was his first run for office. And then and now, to be the county attorney in a county, you have to live in the county seat. So he moved from Casa Grande to Florence. And he lived there not the rest of his life, but all through his political life. He kept a home in Florence. He actually moved from that home in 1941 after his election to the U.S. Senate. But that's another part of the big story.
Mm-hmm. As you've done research for this particular project and book, do you know what he loves so much about Arizona? I mean, I hear the legal side of things and, of course, the fact that he's made such a change, a difference for us. But from a heart perspective and just a human perspective, do you know what it is that he loved about Arizona?
Yes, I do. Florence.
Really?
He loved Florence, Arizona. He lived in Phoenix for a short time, didn't like it, was too big, too busy. Didn't remind him of Oklahoma at all. He moved to Casa Grande, and that was an agricultural area at the time. Different kind of agriculture, of course. Dry farming, for the most part. Moved to Florence to be the county attorney in Florence. But back then, it was a part-time job. So it didn't require his full effort. He practiced law at the same time as he was practicing as a prosecutor, as the county attorney. But he truly fell in love with Florence and its people. And he stayed there for a long, long period of time, 20 years. He's well-known still today. Yeah, I spent a lot of time in Florence. Well, I spent a couple of weeks in Florence. That's not, I guess, a long time in the abstract. But even today, when I would talk to people in restaurants and lots of other local venues, it was amazing how many people knew. Now, not the young people necessarily, but there were a lot of people in their 40s and 50s who couldn't have been there when Mac was there. He was there in the 20s and the 30s. But they knew about Ernest McFarland. Well, the McFarland State Park is there. There's a library.
I was going to ask what has been named in his honor.
His connection is still very strong down there. But he learned a lot about how to interact with people. And he learned a lot about politics, but it was small town politics. It was what today would be called retail politics. There were no wholesale politics.
So I don't know that term. Can you help me with that? What is a retail?
Sure. Today, people run on large platforms. They run on TV. They run on radio. They run on ads. They run on commercials. They run on platforms. They run on large media budgets. They're successful or not, largely depending on how good they are at raising money. Mac ran by himself. He was a shoe leather politician, if there ever was one. He shook hands. He smiled. They had rallies in those days, but it wasn't a rally for the politician. It was a rodeo or a dance or a gathering of all the local people in rural places. And he went to all of those, and they became rallies, but they weren't there for him. He was there for them. That's the big difference between retail politics and today's wholesale politics. So it was fun finding out all of that. He licked his own stamps, stuck them on the envelopes. He didn't type the letters. His secretary did that, but he dictated them, and he answered them quickly as the letters came in. One of the things I discovered that I never thought really existed before, because I haven't looked for that kind of thing, the state archives have his official papers as governor, as chief justice, and all of his Senate papers as well. There are 171 linear feet of boxes.
Of all.
And in each box, there are hundreds and hundreds of pieces of paper. So when you get to the part where his letters were kept, particularly his political letters in the 1940 campaign, and then campaigns after that one, but you find hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of letters in the same box with his reply back, or his first letter to that person, or his reply back. So I discovered that letter writing process, which today we would call electronic mail, we do the same thing, but we do it in a very different format. Those letters were very formal. They took time to dictate. It was always, "Dear Mrs. Jones, I hope you and the family are doing well." Some sentence like that started off every letter, and the responses did too.
I'm fascinated. So I just got a letter, a thank you letter, handwritten. I was sharing with Dan, our studio ambassador, the other day. I get thank you notes quite a bit, and of course emails, and I love that. I always appreciate being acknowledged. A gentleman sent me a handwritten letter, you know, the trifold,
yes,
and just like you're describing. Yeah. And there was something so special about that. And we just don't do that very frequently anymore. You know, it's usually, if it's handwritten at all, it's a very quick little card. But this was literally an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper with letterhead, yeah, and a thank you, and just keeping me up to date as to what he's been doing since then. So how neat that obviously there are a few people who continue this tradition. I'm curious, as you're describing this, was McFarland a family man? And in that, what was that part of his life like? And who was responsible for maintaining and keeping all this stuff for him?
Mac was.
Yes, thank you.
Largely.
He was himself.
He kept track of everything. He was a well-organized, both as a businessman and as a politician. He started the first TV station in Arizona. He created KTVK, Channel 3.
Really?
He was the first owner. He ran that company for many, many, many years, not while he was actively in politics, but that's one of his larger legacies. Was the ABC affiliate for many, many years in Phoenix. That's a longer story than I didn't tell the story much in my book. I did a little bit about that. But the reason why the book is different is that you have to put it into context with the other McFarland books. There is a magnificent 816-page political biography by an extremely competent historian, Dr. James McMillan. And that's a huge volume that records and reflects and reports on every part of his political life, and to some extent, every part of his business life, too, because he was an enormously successful and wealthy businessman after his political career. So when I first read that book, I realized that there needs to be no other book that would fully explain the politics and the changes that Mac went through. What was missing from that book was much about Mac's early years from 1920 to 1940, just to put that into context. So when the family asked me to, well, they interviewed me and asked me what I thought about another book, I eventually told them that I thought the book was probably in figuring out who Mack was from 1920 to 1940, before he became a senator, before he became a majority leader of the Senate, before he found a young senator to help him manage the Senate. As you know, this majority leader has a whip, so Mack needed some young, competent man to be a senator, because they were all men at the time. He picked Lyndon Baines Johnson. LBJ was Mack's whip in the Senate. But before that, there had to be something much more complicated that I could not find. And what I couldn't find was the driver, or how many drivers there were. Turns out that family life was an enormous driver in the most tragic possible way. When he was at Stanford, he met a young woman. Her name was Claire Collins. She was an undergraduate at Stanford. He was a law student at Stanford. They didn't connect for many years after that, but that's where he met her. She became a teacher in, of all places, Florence, Arizona.
Oh, my goodness.
So they dated for a while. They got married in the 20s. They had three children in the space of 22 months total. The youngest child died. The next child died. The third child died. And Claire died.
Oh, my goodness.
In the space of 22 months. So that kind of catastrophic thing in his life was the second big one. The first one, of course, was when he was in the hospital in the U.S. Navy. He nearly died as a result of that. He nearly died as a result of losing his family. So once he did that, then he created himself once again, reinvented himself once again, and ran for judge. And he became the Pinal County judge. Halfway through that, he met another high school teacher in Florence. She was a widow. She had a young child. Her name was Jewel. So he married Edna. And 2 years later, he went to the U.S. Senate. And he took Edna and Jewel. And Jewel became a huge part of his life. She was, I think, 8 when they got married and 11 when they went to Washington, D.C. So it's, all of this became such a big part of his life. But not in the state archives. Almost none of that is in the state archives.
I'm fascinated by that and not surprised. One, in the short time I've gotten to know you, you know, in all of, what, 30 minutes today, I can sense that this would be the nugget that you would go looking for to help tell a bigger picture and give us a better history about who he is. And oftentimes, we so want to avoid the difficult conversations. And I can imagine back when, I don't know when this other historian wrote the story, it would make sense that most people would want to focus on the legacy as it relates to the government and water history and that sort of thing. And thank you for telling the full story and giving this an opportunity, because as you said, and I was listening for that. What makes him tick? What drove him? What led him to want to give in this way? And certainly these life experiences had to have shaped him.
Well, those basic facts, the fact of the date that Claire died, the date that William Jr. died, Jean-Claire was the daughter, and then the last child was Juliet. She was stillborn, but named. That was not a secret to anybody in Florence. It was well known by everybody in Florence and lots of other people in Arizona, but there's no public record of it. There was a very small obituary on purpose. So it took me months to figure out why there's not a large public record about this, and I did discover it. It's because Mack didn't want it in public. He kept his private life private. He kept the things that were tragic to him private. There were other people that knew about them and that helped him get through it and past it and over it. But this was not an accident that there's no record of this. This was on purpose.
So, which begs me to ask, when the family interviewed you and you suggested that this was a piece of the story that needed to be told, you have to do that with gentle care, out of respect for who he was as a private man. So can you just share a little bit about that Was the family ever at a point where they're like, oh, we don't know if we want to tell this part of the story?
Well, John Lewis is the grandson. He's Mac's grandson, and he's sort of the leader of the family. I think he's the middle kid of the five, but they're all five very interested and very devoted to and literally doted on their grandfather. But these people came of age in the 50s and 60s and 70s. By then, he was not in the Senate anymore. He was the governor, but they were little kids. They didn't know that. And so as I talked to, primarily to John Lewis about these other things that I was finding out, he said, we wanted to know about that, but we were grandkids in the 60s and 70s. And so we looked up at him as our grandfather. We knew there was another family. We didn't know much about it. Turns out there wasn't much I could tell them about it. But I did find some things, and the things that I thought were relevant and helped explain how Mac became Mac. This is certainly an opinion, not a fact. But in my opinion, Mac became Mac because of the tragic things that happened to them and the support he got from the community he lived in during those times. He was getting over his dire illness and near death in the U.S. Navy in Florence. And the people in Florence helped him. And he got over the loss of his first family because the people of Florence helped him get over it. There are other larger places where he might have lived, and it might have been different. I don't know that. That's pure speculation. But I can tell from what little I could find that the other challenge was that there were not very many people who knew him well back then and were still alive, as I'm researching this book, 2 years ago. And so there was an inability to find people that really knew him in the Florence environment. But it was such a strong environment for him and for everybody else down there. Florence had its problems, in the sense that it lost the main route. The reason Florence was important was it was exactly halfway between Tucson and Phoenix. And you couldn't drive. They had cars back then. They were neat cars, but you couldn't drive from Phoenix to Tucson or back without going through Florence. Florence got bypassed at a much later point in time. But during the time Mac lived there, this was how you got from being, stopping halfway was sort of a big deal. It worked very much that way. But that the takeaway I got from Mac's insistence that these private parts of his life be kept private, they weren't things that he wanted to talk about much, and he didn't want people talking about him, about it, or those events. But it changed his character in many ways. You can look at the U.S., the GI Bill in Congress in 1944 and think about what Mac went through when he got out of the Navy, just as World War was winding down at that point. Soldiers returning from the war in Europe were selling apples on the streets. They were living in tents. They had no health care. They had no way to get back into the workforce, and there was no educational benefit at all. That drove Mac all the way through his years in the Senate. And you can see it in the way he crafted the unique portions of the GI Bill, the portions that dealt with education, with health care, with job development and job retention. All of that came from Mac. There were a lot of other senators involved, and there were a lot of military people involved. The American Legion was deeply involved in crafting that bill. But you can see the pieces in it as you carefully pick it apart. And Jim McMullen did that. I didn't have to go back and do that research because Jim McMullen had done it. As a side note, I'll tell you how I met Jim McMullen, because it bears on what happened here eventually. I wrote a book about the famous case of Miranda versus Arizona. Ernest McFarland was the Chief Justice at the time, and he wrote the opinion in Miranda versus Arizona. And of course, he got overruled by the United States Supreme Court. So that's what made the case famous. But I wrote my book on Miranda in 2004, and that's the same year that Jim McMullen released his book on Ernest McFarland in 2004. And so we were both invited to make a presentation at the Arizona Historical Society in Tucson in October of 2004. And Jim and I both made presentations for our book. And they had a book signing. They had a little card table set up. There were seven or eight authors. And I sat next to Jim McMillan. And I didn't know him at the time, but we had a long three-hour afternoon to sit there and sign books and wait for somebody to come up and buy one. I sold more books than Jim McMillan did because mine was thinner. It didn't scare people. But we had a long talk about Miranda and McFarland's role in Miranda. It was just kind of a magic day. We also had a talk about, I tried to write Miranda as a story, and he tried to write McFarland as history. So we had a conversation. I still remember bits of the conversation about the difference between writing story and writing history. So there's history in the Miranda decision, obviously legal history and important cultural and civil history. But there's also a story in Miranda, so I tried to tell it in that book, and he thought it was interesting and a bit odd that a writer would focus on story rather than making sure that the story was accurate. That's what Dr. McMillan did. He made an accurate, perfect rendition of Mac's political and public life. I tried to write this book to tell people today what it was like then. What else was going on? What was happening? How did Florence sustain itself through the droughts and the depression in the 30s? And it's very different than it was in the Midwest. It would have been very different for Mac had he stayed there, but he didn't. Eventually, all of his family came back to Arizona. His parents, all of his siblings, aunts and uncles, everybody eventually migrated out of Oklahoma and to Arizona over time and were very involved in Mac's, because it was a large family. They came to Florence for Thanksgiving a lot.
Fascinating. And this approach to telling the story as a story, you got to do that because other books had already been written more historically.
Yes.
And it's also, with how many books, Gary, do you have? You have 13?
I have 12.
12 books. Have they all been done with this idea around telling the story and what's been happening in those times in addition to the subject that you're writing about as well? Is that kind of your thing?
Well, it is. The nonfiction books, I have 6 nonfiction books, and they all involve, to a greater or lesser extent, large legal issues, legal stories, legal cases, legal consequences, judges, lawyers, defendants, plaintiffs, litigants, jurors are in all of my nonfiction books. 3 of them are published by the University of Arizona Press, and they like that kind, and I like that kind of academic writing. But I've also written 5 novels, and so when I write, and I try to write simultaneous, I write a novel and a nonfiction at the same time, and I move back and forth between the two things.
What's that do
because,
for you?
Yeah. Well, keeping the story at the front of your mind when you're writing down history or business or some other consequence like that.
So the
that,
accuracy is there.
It is there. If I'm writing a novel at the same time, I'm building that story out of nothing, out of straw, out of clay. That's not true for the nonfiction. There I'm forced to write in a positive way about the facts. But I want to tell the story of how those facts came to be. Why are they important? Is this fact, does it explain the character of the character? In some way. And so that's what I've tried to do in all these books. And as I get just slightly older, I'm going to focus more on the story behind important events than the event itself. Because I love that whole process of finally figuring it out. And when I finally figured out that Mac did not want us to know much about Claire's death or the children's death. He didn't want us to know much about how his family reacted when he nearly died in that hospital in Illinois. And that was purposeful, but not in a way that was secretive. The records are there.
Yeah.
The U.S. Navy records are quite sparse. I've got them. I've got the all 3 of the telegrams, each of whom was not a full sentence long, to his mother about his condition. the third of the three telegrams said, McFarland in hospital, recovery doubtful, period. That's the letter. That's the telegram.
To his mother.
To his mother. And she knew almost nothing about this. So that those kinds of things came out later. They're not in the other books, I think. And the reason I'm confident that I'm right is because Jim McMillan's book has about 60 pages that deal with the era in Florence and his private life. McFarland wrote his own autobiography in 1979, and it's not as thick a book, but it's a long book. It's in the 400-page range with small font. He mentioned the fact that he lost Claire and their children as a parenthetical phrase in the middle of a sentence halfway through the book. Am I convinced that he didn't want us to know? You bet. He never talked about it to his grandchildren, and that's perfectly understandable for all kinds of other reasons.
Of course, so. And yet it makes for a fascinating conversation today as you take a look back at his life, the history, the legacy, on behalf of the family, which is really neat. And I can see why, of course, that they've selected you with this important project.
I don't know why they selected me, but I'm overjoyed that they did.
You have a few hunches, don't you, as to why? Surely they've given you some feedback.
Well, one of the family members is married to a lawyer friend of mine from Flagstaff. His name is Fritz Aspie. He's the managing partner in Flagstaff's largest and best law firm. I have to say that because Fritz is my friend, but it's also true.
True.
But Fritz has read my other books. And I rode horses on something called the Verde Vaquero Ride for a lot of years with Fritz. And so we shared stories over time. And when the family decided they wanted to have another book about Mac, written by someone outside the family, they asked about it. And Fritz says, well, I know Gary Stewart. So let me give him a call. We'll see. And so I interviewed not all of the members of the family, but certainly John and Bill and Kara. And they had lots of questions. What do you think about the book? And I said, well, I think he doesn't need another political biography. I don't think the world needs that. McMillan did it, and I couldn't improve on it ever. So, but there is a personal story, I suspect. I don't know. I haven't looked yet.
But let's go find out.
So I can remember asking them, what do you think about it? Is this a love story? Was Mac's love for Arizona, his love for law, his love for the rule of law, was that big enough to sustain this march from 1920 to 1940? Turns out it was. They didn't really know that, and neither did I. Or is this a classic Western? I've written three Westerns, and I read a lot of Westerns. The classic Western, of course, has the same plot. It's the same plot in every Western you can think of. Stranger comes to town. That's it. Now, sometimes a stranger rides in on a magnificent horse. Sometimes comes in a stagecoach. Sometimes in the back of a wagon. But everybody pays attention in that little town, whatever little town it happens to be. And however big it happens to be, everybody pays attention. This is a stranger. What's he want? How long is he going to be here? Think he's going to stay? That's what happened to Mac. He was a stranger in Florence. They adopted him and he adopted them, not just the people, but the way of life, the culture in Florence. And so over time, that could have been a classic Western story. It could have been an interwars story. There are a lot of those. Things that happened, people that came of age between the First World War and the Second World War, who were greatly influenced by the First World War and petrified by the Second. So when he ran for office, that became a huge issue. What's the platform of the Democratic Party? What's the platform of the Republican Party? Are they alike? Are they close on the looming issues of World War II? This is 2 years before Pearl Harbor. But the positions were very, very different. The Republican position was much more hesitant. The Democratic position was much more determined to prepare for war, to spend the money in 1939 and in 1940 and 1941 in advance of Pearl Harbor and make sure that we were ready when and if we had to become involved, when we had no choice. So a lot of the political rhetoric was about that. And it was fascinating in retrospect to read, because even though I was alive during the war, I knew nothing about it. I was a child. But that's just a second generation passed back.
We could do a whole series with Gary, couldn't we? Just a wealth of knowledge. And I can't, unfortunately, keep you all day because I know you have a fortunate opportunity to have KTVK joining you for a little interview today.
Yes.
About Call Me Mac.
About Call Me Mac, yes.
And that's the syndicate that you said that he opened that TV station all those years ago. How he fun did. Is that? That's probably part of the draw for them coming to celebrate with you today.
So do you know how I knew how to do all that?
How did you know?
They wrote the FCC bill in Congress. That's why.
You did?
No, he did.
He did.
He did.
And
so all of that, all of TV then was covered by the Federal Communications Commission. And the FCC was set up in accordance with legislation that Mac had a large role in. So from the legal perspective and the governance perspective, he knew everything there was to know. And there was no TV station. He started it. Mm-hmm. And he picked KTVK for this reason, is that it had TV in the middle.
Ah.
So it was KTVK. And it had to start with K for some arcane reason that I've now forgotten.
Yeah. But Dan would know. Dan's nodding his head, so, our producer.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's how it started. And
It
ended for Mac in terms of management, but many of his children were involved in the station. They worked for the station. They grew up. Some of them worked there in high school, others during classes in college, summertimes, other members. So it was not a full family business. There were other people involved, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of his family is connected to Channel 3.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Let's talk about the reception. Because you have a Call Him Mac book signing and reception coming up on Thursday the 25th. Tell us where that will be located and who's welcome to join you.
All of my students. I teach in that law school. It's a fine law school. It's named after Senator O'Connor. I practiced law in Arizona for a long time. She was a trial judge. I tried cases in front of her as a trial judge. I argued cases in front of her as a appeals judge in Arizona. I always wished I'd get a chance to argue in the United States Supreme Court while she was on it, but never did. But I got to sit in her seat in the audience area a couple of times. She was if you were a Phoenix or if you were an Arizona lawyer and you wanted to watch a Supreme Court hearing and an argument, you were always welcome to sit in one. She had two seats up front. So they were her seats and she gave them out quite freely. But that's the place where this reception will be held. KTVK is going to cover it that night, but I expect we'll have a nice mix of people. The former president of ASU, Laddie Coor, is going to introduce me. I've known Laddie for a long, long time. And so that'll be great fun for both of us, I hope. But the family will all be there. They're going to sit for questions. And John Lewis is sort of the instigator of all of this. He'll have some words to say. I hope I get to sign a few books.
No doubt will you sign plenty of books, I'm sure. It is free to the public. I remember seeing that. Again, it's the Call Him Mac book signing and reception with Gary Stewart, Thursday, October 25th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at ASU Sandra Day O'Connor Institute of Law and the Center for Law and Society. That is at 111 Taylor Street. It happens to be room 544 and the patio in Phoenix. So, if you are available, and if you're not, change your schedule and make a point to be there. It's really been a pleasure to get to know you. And with just a few minutes left, I have a couple questions about you specifically. With all the writing that you've done and all the knowledge that you have and how you've served our community, there's got to be a book that you're going to be writing about yourself at some point. Am I right? I mean, really, even just because here we're talking about Mac. But every once in a while, you're interjecting these little vignettes about who you are as a professional and a contributor. So I've got to know when that book is coming out, Gary.
You'll have to ask my wife.
Okay, I will.
she'll take care of that long after I'm dead and gone.
You see that being something that after you've...
No.
Yeah?
No, I seriously don't.
No.
I have written part of my life story intended only for my grandkids because they weren't around while Kathleen and I, we met in college. We married in college. One of our kids was born in college. And then we celebrated our 55th wedding anniversary just a month ago. All of that will pass on to other people. I'm not going to be involved in writing my story.
And yet it's written and it's there for the family to consume and enjoy and maybe give the rest of us a glimpse. Well, but at some point, yes. Yeah, at least it is. It's not the big mystery that Mac had left for you as far as some of this piece.
Well, I've written a great deal, of course, but not so much about myself. I'm not nearly as interested as I am interested in things.
Mm-hmm. And stories.
And stories.
Yeah, stories. Yeah. For me as a learner, if it were a textbook or academically written, I would be hard-pressed to read. It would be very hard for me. So to have books like this that are part of our educational process or even just to enjoy through storytelling, that's everything to me. I mean, it's part of why I do Phoenix Business Radio, right? Because we get to have these conversations and these beautiful stories, no matter who we're talking to, somebody who owns a window washing company with his son at ASU, to Greg Stanton, to yourself, to everybody in between. Stories come out in conversation. And it's just a very natural part of obviously how we communicate. So thank you for sharing the gift of story on behalf of Mac and his family today. It's just been a fascinating conversation.
Thanks for listening to me.
Absolutely. And so, again, for folks who can join Gary and the family for the reception, it is Call Him Mac, the book and reception on Thursday, the 25th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. again at ASU Sandra Day O'Connor Institute. And for folks who would like to get their hands on a book, what's the best way for them to get the book if they can't make it to this particular event?
Yeah, it was... The book process by which at least academic books are published is quite interesting. So on October 16th is the formal release date, the official release date for this book. It's been up on Amazon for about a month, but the formal date is till October 16th.
Okay.
It's also on the University of Arizona Press website. You can buy it there. You can order it there, or you can get it from Amazon. All the royalties go to the foundation. Foundation is designed, of course, to advance and secure Ernest McFarland's legacy. So I'm thrilled that that's going to be. I did not think this would be a large seller, and I still don't know that, of course. Nobody knows yet. But I can tell you that the University of Arizona Press people that publish this book, they think it's going to be a good seller for them because it's such an interesting story when you think about all the things that this one single individual did, all the people that must have been involved as well. There are lots and lots and lots of people. So they all have children and they don't really know what it was like living in a small town in Arizona in the 20s and the 30s. So I've got a whole chapter on Florence. I learned a lot about Florence just from writing this book. I mean, it actually had a big river running through it, the Gila River. It's mostly dry now. But life's different, so it was fun, such a fun book to figure out. That was the most fun part. The writing was great fun. I loved that. But figuring out what the story was, that's the part that drives me. And I'm hoping to get more commissions to write books because it gives me more time, more freedom.
And how can somebody inquire about that if they have a story that they know needs to be told? How do folks get a hold of you for that kind of conversation?
I have a website. It's GaryLStewart.com.
GaryLStewart.com.
I also write an ethics blog on the ethics of writing. Some of my books have been professional books about ethics. I taught ethics for a long, long time. And I've written a lot about it. So, but my new blog is The Ethics of Writing. And so I talk about what are the norms, the expectations, the modes in poetry or fiction or memoir or journalism or tweets. So it's an awful lot of fun just doing that. But There's a place on my book site for commission writing as a way to contact me. You can do it from the site directly. Because I know that there are other stories out there that are begging to be told, but a lot of people don't know how to find somebody to do that, that has a common interest or a common perspective. And in the case of Mac, it was really easy because we were both lawyers. In other cases, in Miranda, I knew some of the people that were involved in that case. But it's this reality of turning fascinating history, digging into it deep enough to find out what the story about that history is. One reporter, after Mac died, wondered whether or not he had the makings. He said that in his story. I wondered if this guy had the makings. M-A-K-I-N-S, apostrophe, mm-hmm. Makings. It's from old hand-rolled cigarettes. That's the makings. But if you have the makings to be what you become, that's something. That's really something. So he wondered about that. It turns out that Mac was a natural in all of this.
Well, it sure sounds like it.
But he worked hard to get there, to get that feel, to understand what's the intersection between political science and law. And where does sociology fit in? How much do we know about the sociology of politicians? Mac wrote about it, and he lived it. Much of his legislation is created on that. His best friends often were members of the opposing party. He was selected as majority leader primarily because everybody in both parties liked him and trusted him. That's how he got the job. That's not how they're connected, how they are elected today. They're elected in their own caucus, and if they've got the votes, then that's where the majority leader comes from. That was the case then, too. But in his case, they wanted somebody who understood the Republicans in the United States Senate at the time. They're about to come. They've gone through much of World War II. And there are going to be enormous problems at the end of World War II. Everybody knew that. Mac's a perfect choice for majority leader of the Senate in that setting because he was liked and trusted by everybody.
Hmm. Will you have an opportunity to read a few passages from the book at the celebration?
That's up to somebody else.
Sure. I'm putting in a good word for you to do that. I would love to hear you read from the book. And truly, this has been a fascinating conversation. You're a fascinating individual. And what a legacy and a gift that you've provided not only the family, but the state of Arizona, the Florence community, and obviously our nation by taking time to bring this story to life and really bound it and provide it as literature for us. Yeah. So thank you again.
Karen, it was wonderful meeting you and finding out how interested you are in a story that you didn't know.
But right. Yeah. That's why I love so much about this opportunity with Business Radio X. It's really around stories and just hearing from people who have that passion and that purpose. And in some way, shape, or form, a legacy to share. And here you are giving that gift to a family that has become, it sounds like, really part of your own family as well through this experience and this research. So again, I can't thank you enough. And again, look to Gary's website, GaryLStewart.com, for more opportunities to hear from Gary. There's a blog there that talks about the writing.
The ethics of writing.
And the book, Call Him Mac, is available not only on Amazon, but also through the University of Arizona Press.
Yes.
And I'm going to have to talk to Suzanne about getting you back here again for another conversation around just YOU, if you'd be open to that.
Sure.
Excellent. You've been listening to Phoenix Business Radio with Business Radio X, broadcasting live from within Mac 6 and the Conscious Capitalism Arizona studio. Some media leans left, some lean right, and we lean business. Until next time, I'm Karen Nowicki.